You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show this evening. You would have seen perhaps today's announcement from the finance minister, a 14-point government inclusive growth plan. Okay, so we've got that. It's pages and words. Not anybody's been particularly kind about it. We'll talk to a whole bunch of economists this evening to get their insight. Now, I asked you during our headlines, I said to you, what is the best collective noun for economists? Now, somebody is saying, Matthew is saying, there is a real, Tikiso, can you check this out, please? Tikiso, my producer. Is the collective noun, it's a parliament of owls, is it really a recession of economists? I find that too good to be believed. But, you know, let's check it out, Matthew. We'll check it out. An estimate of economists, says Robbie. A confusion of economists, says the unkind Tafara. It's a cacophony of economists. Ooh, that's too alliterative. An index of economists, says Simon. A hand of economists. Maybe it's a backhand of consultants. But what is a collective noun for economists? We have that institute, and we're waiting for you this evening, a bank of economists. Well, nice, Patrick McKay. At SEPO, a gang of economists, not very kind. So, lots of ideas coming through this evening. We'll talk to one economist after the other this evening to get their view on the finance minister's proposals. Also tonight, we are going to be speaking to a man called Sam Byrne-James. He's the news editor at PR Week in London. This is an industry magazine in the United Kingdom, talking all about, of course, the trouble and those nice people at Bell Pottinger find themselves in. Bernard Hartz, the head of business crimes and investigations at Worksmans. Consequences for foreign companies found guilty or found wanting even, or found even to be slightly dodge after the Gupta leaks. Warren Ingram telling you what you can learn from watching Wimbledon. It's not just a passive activity. You can watch Wimbledon and get financial guidance through that process. Pablo Fatidis on why your company's brand is the most important thing that you own and why you must never allow that out of your control. All of that tonight on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
Today's fast fact. Which bank is bending over backwards to keep its nerds happy? Its nerdiest nerds. I mean, banks are full of nerds. But the nerdiest of the nerds in some banks are unhappy. There's one particular bank that wants to keep the nerdiest of the nerds happy, and it's bending over backwards to do so. Which is that bank? That's tonight's fast fact here on The Money Show. Well, did you watch the Finance Minister Molusi Gigaba present government's inclusive growth plan today? He did say many of the right things. Avoid populism. We've got to take corruption seriously. We need growth. And then he delivered and a plan that I'm struggling to be inspired by, that you might be struggling to be inspired by, but I'm hoping this collection of economists back-to-back this evening will be inspired by. Let's get senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Science at Wits, Lumkile Mondi's assessment this evening. Are you inspired and motivated by this 14-point plan, Lumkile?
I am as deflated as many other South Africans, given the fact that the consumer is under stress. We're seeing companies closing down at Fraport's earlier this week, closing down. We've got job losses. We're in a recession. And the minister seems to be having no plan at all as to how to immediately inspire South Africans, both business and consumers, that, you know, we can really turn it around. So it's all another plan. After 9-point plan, now it's a 14-point plan. It was the new growth path, but no action. So it's really a state of paralysis where there's plans, but no leadership and no implementation.
But here's the thing. I look at this apparent plan, and it's got, you know, 14 categories with subcategories in it, and all of it looks like more regulation, more rules, more propping up of state-owned enterprises, more consultation, more of the same as we've seen for the last 10, 15 years or so out of many well-meaning policymakers. But we're doing more of the same, and the same hasn't worked. So why are we presenting more of the same in a different guise?
Because we don't have ideas, Bruce. We don't have ideas within the state because we have had so much intellectual loss within the state. Some of it had to do with a shadow state who is very much intolerant with those that are committed to working for the public. But get cronies into this state institution, including the state itself, where they'll follow instructions and, if needs be, allow non-South Africans to get citizenship in a very short space of time using powers that the current Minister of Finance had. So it's really a situation whereby we are very scared to say, South Africans, we actually don't know what to do. Therefore, if we don't know what to do, we need to call in those that have been there, done that, including within the ANC. I mean, if you look in the finance ministry, we have people like Tito Mboweni, who had performed superbly in the Reserve Bank position and went for Malusi Gigaba. So it's all these choices that are being made.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if Malusi Gigaba's returned Tito Mboweni's call yet, but I spoke to Tito Mboweni about 6 weeks ago, and I said to him, you're critical of what's going on in South Africa at the moment. Have you made an offer? He says, no, I've left a message at the office that if the finance minister wants my assistance, he must give me a call. I don't know if that call is being made. Now, Lumkile, we're putting you under pressure here, but if you were to give today's plan a score out of 10, what might it be?
It's so dismal, Bruce. I'm sorry. As a proudly South African who's worked very hard within the state trying to push this economy forward, it's a reversal, Bruce. I think I'll give it 2 out of 10.
Jeez. Okay. Lumkile Mondi. There was a punch. It was not pulled. Lumkile Mondi, 2 out of 10. Nasmira Mula, economist and strategist at Investec Asset Management. Do you see any sort of opportunities within this 14-point plan to stimulate growth, Nasmira?
Good evening, Bruce. I think there's some real opportunities to stimulate growth. I mean, if we think about one of the biggest problems right now that South Africa is facing is a lack of confidence. If the finance ministry manages to do everything it's detailed regarding SOEs, that will certainly help confidence. I don't think the plan overall does enough, but I do think there are real opportunities here.
It looks like a clunky, complicated, far too much cooperation required from far too many disparate people and far too many organizations, state-owned enterprises, government departments, for it in the short term to have any huge impact on dragging us out of recession.
I think that's a fair point, and I think that in order to create growth in the long term, it is going to be far too much coordination between far too many departments. That's what good governments are able to do, and that's what South Africa's failed to do historically.
Yeah, but we're nowhere near that space, which to my mind makes this plan unworkable.
Bruce, right now the first thing we need to do is get confidence restarted. And if we start doing some real things to improve governance of state-owned companies, that starts to go a long way.
Okay, I mean, when you look at the ideals contained in it, yes, there are lots of good ideals and there are lots of lovely plans, but is there anything new in it which you look at and you go, boy, that's a smart idea that's going to kickstart a segment of the economy, for example?
I don't think we need new smart ideas. I think we just need to implement the ideas that we do have. That's what we've failed at repeatedly over the years. So the question for me is not, is this plan good enough? The question is, how much commitment is there to implementation?
Okay, commitment to implementation, but then the finance minister could have said that, and we wouldn't have needed a new plan to gather dust. Would you give it a score out of 10? You're sounding as if you're going to give him the benefit of the doubt on this one, Nasmira.
I think that we need to acknowledge the fact that he's making an effort. I don't think it goes far enough in certain areas, but in the areas that he controls, I think he's done a reasonable job. I mean, overall, I think it's sort of 6.5 out of 10. It's a passing grade. You know, I would have liked to see something much more concrete from mining. I thought that was terribly wishy-washy, given that we've had a disastrous mining charter released not so long ago.
Yep.
I would have liked to see a little bit more from the telecommunications space around digital migration. Perhaps it is in one of those 5 points they made. I'm just not smart enough to understand which one. And I would have liked to see a little bit more on labor and labor functioning. But I think in terms of the areas the finance minister himself has some real influence on, particularly around state-owned companies. Bruce, I know you probably think I'm overly harping on it.
No, not at all. But it's just, and that's, I think, the critical point there is the area over which the finance minister has control, because he does have limited influence, unfortunately, across the entire economy, which is why I'm more skeptical than you as to the workability of this great plan.
I think that in the current environment, given the sclerosis in government ahead of the ANC elective conference at the end of the year, my expectations are very low. If they manage to get some real progress on state-owned companies through, I will be positively surprised.
Lovely.
And I think a lot of people in this country will also be positively surprised.
Certainly surprised. Nasmira Mulla, thank you. Economist and strategist at Investec Asset Management. The sclerosis in government. Good analogy. Siya Biniza is a political economist. A political economist this evening on the line to us from Tshwane. Now, you've got an advantage over our other commentators this evening, Siya, because you understand the complexity of the policy environment firsthand. You've worked in the National Treasury as an economist. Explain to me the complexity, please, of what the finance minister has delivered today.
Sure. Well, I think partly, firstly, the challenge is that our monetary policy has been caught out of cycle. And the challenge is that the Saab needs to retain its independence for its financial and international credibility. But at the same time, the government is also trying to get the economy moving. So the complexity is, how do we then, and also we're faced with the challenges of inequality, which is driving up the social welfare costs, creating high dependency and reducing inclusiveness in the economy generally, which also brings down economic growth. And so the government is really placed with the challenge of trying to coordinate things that are partly out of its mandate, but trying to do the most with what it has currently. The fiscus is really pressured. As mentioned, there's been a steep rise in our social welfare costs and other costs in terms of education and others due to inequality and the slow growth and poverty we're faced with. But at the same time, although our financial sector has been doing well in terms of the exchange rate, this has had a negative effect on our manufacturing and exporting industries, which is partly to blame for the slow growth. The current figures are showing the sharpest decline comes from the trade and catering sectors, as well as manufacturing, which have been hurt by the fact that the rand has been strong. The rand is currently projected to appreciate by about 13% this year, following a 4% depreciation last year. And that means that our manufacturing and other export industries cannot export because the goods are expensive.
And that's all good, Siya, but is there anything in this plan that says, okay, this is our reality, and this is how we're going to operate in this reality? We're going to make it easier to start a business. We're going to incentivize people to dig holes in the ground with a 20-year view. We're going to liberalize, and I know that's a filthy word in politics, but we're going to make it easier to do business. I don't see anything here, and I've looked hard, that says we're going to make it easier to do business and we're going to spend less and we're going to earn more.
Well, I think partly that is not within the mandate of the National Treasury. You must understand that the National Treasury's mandate is fiscal management, so management of public finances. At the same time, they have tried to collaborate with other departments, although this has been scant in terms of the plans.
Yeah.
There's collaboration with the ASDB, Department of Small Business Development. But I don't feel that there is enough collaboration with the DTI. The only mention of collaboration with the DTI is around the issue of credit and giving credit relief, particularly for the reckless lending that has taken place.
Yeah.
But part of that, creating a business environment that's conducive, doesn't sit directly with the National Treasury. So it depends on collaborating with other departments.
Completely.
Which has been done.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's been done sufficiently in this plan.
Because what this plan requires is if government is an orchestra and every government minister is playing a different instrument, the conductor's role in that orchestra is to get all of the instruments playing in harmony, playing their particular part so that the orchestra sounds decent and doesn't sound like 40 different musical instruments making a noise. And at the moment, our economy is 40 different musical instruments making a noise, and the conductor is too busy in his own affairs to pull this entire orchestra together, the conductor being the president in this particular case. Is that not the core of the problem?
Yes, and I think partly, if I could just run with your metaphor, that I think partly the challenge is that a lot of the musicians in the orchestra are sitting with the other people's instruments. So you've got a guitarist sitting with the saxophone, for example. And the challenge is they're not really coming together because the people aren't understanding the governance state and the mandates that they have. Typically, the biggest challenge, I think, with the coordination in government is that the mandate typically sits with people without capacity. And when the people with the capacity are there, they don't have the mandate. And so there is this mismatch in our policy.
Yeah.
So I also feel that perhaps we're placing a bit too much pressure on the finance minister, given his mandate and what he's capable to do. Okay. But what needs to be done is to rein in all of the dormant parts of government and also have a cross-governmental evaluation. The plan doesn't really speak to any of that. There's hardly any mention of the Department of Measurement and Evaluation, for example. The focus primarily is on legislating public procurement to enable inclusive growth. And I think that can only go so far without evaluating the efficient use of those resources. And we must also understand that the process of transformation is going to be riddled with failures.
Sure.
And the problem is that with the limited fiscal space, there's very little attitude or there's very little appetite for experimenting. And in order to break the barriers and, you know, drive inclusive growth, we need to experiment. And it's going to be riddled with failures. But the role of the National Treasury should be to guide the efficiency of those government programs in their experimentation.
Siya, thank you very much. You're a score out of 10?
I would score it a 6.
Okay. All right, Siya, thank you. And I can understand why. Siya Biniza, thank you very much. A political economist, former economist within the National Treasury. He's got that sort of, he understands the huge complexity of actually operating within that environment. So I really appreciate his views this evening. Siya Biniza, Nasmira Mula, Lumkile Mondi, 2 out of 10. And Nasmira, a generous 6.5. And an experienced 6 out of 10 from Siya this evening, giving an average of just under 50% for the plan. And yeah, the point is that here is an orchestra. The orchestra, firstly, is too big. The orchestra is uncoordinated, and half of the people in the orchestra right now, Sia points out, don't know how to play a musical instrument. That kind of sums up the problem.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Rudy Funabadva, Portfolio Manager at AdviceWorks. Before we talk, Rudy, about today's activity, I just want to remind you, today's fast fact question: which bank is bending over backwards to keep its nerds happy? SMS on 31702 or 31567, or you can tweet me at Bruce Business. Woolies with a trading update, down 5 to 10%. It's not awful, but it's not what we used to out of Woolies.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, certainly not. I mean, I think the market had had expected a disappointing update. But it really isn't what we've become used to. You know, the same source sales seem to be under significant pressure both in South Africa and Australia. You know, at this stage, they're talking about the clothing sales being down 1.4% same store on a same store basis, and food is up sort of 4.6% on a same store basis. David Jones is struggling. You know, the sales there are down 0.7%.
That's in Australia, yeah.
Yes, and Country Road looks like it's also on the same sort of basis, down sort of 0.04 or something. So it shows consumers are under enormous pressure, I think, and that's across their geographies. Australia's economy is driven by a lot of the same factors that ours is, predominantly a commodity-based economy, and people are under pressure. Consumers' disposable income is under pressure, and I think this probably means that, you know, the last couple of years where things were going well for the consumer, Woolies was able to expand their margins quite significantly, and I think they've run out of road on that for the moment.
I mean, banks and retailers generally in a positive space today, and that sort of gives you a sense that next week's Monetary Policy Committee is going to find it far more difficult to say no to an interest rate cut than there have been in the last two meetings, where at least one or two members of the MPC have voted in favour of a cut at previous meetings.
One would think so, Bruce. I think the short-term moves we've seen, the positive moves we've seen in the retailers and the banks, has been partly driven by it looking like international interest rates, specifically in the US, have got less pressure to rise at the moment. But I do think they're running out of excuses not to start cutting interest rates. The economy is under significant pressure here. There isn't any strong inflationary pressure. It seems like food prices are likely to ease as good crops come through after normalization of rainfall in the northern sort of portion of our of our country, and with inflation not being demand driven, rather being driven by the little bit that there is
but
driven
that's
by
why
administered prices. Yeah. They should be cutting rates.
They should be cutting rates. I mean, 50 basis points on Thursday. Let's push Lesi Chakanyahu. He's unpushable, but let's push him. Let's nudge him.
Absolutely.
There we go. Rudy Fundamadva, thank you very much. Rudy Fundamadva is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Today's market was up strongly, 400 points, 53,300. The currency for most of the day was stronger. Commodity prices were a little bit softer. Well, I asked you today's fast fact, which bank is bending over backwards to keep its nerds happy? And I'm very disappointed in you. I'm really disappointed. A couple of you come out and a couple of you going local. This is a global story. No. We don't keep our nerds happy in South Africa, do we? Certainly a couple of you think that local banks are trying to keep their nerds happy. I'm not 100% sure of that being the case, but certainly the Wall Street bank Goldman Sachs, it's relaxing the dress code for its computer engineers. Those are the nerds, by the way. They make up about a quarter of its 33,000 workforce. And what they're trying to do is get techies who want to work in financial services into a more casual environment. Wall Street really does struggle to compete with Silicon Valley, which is far more relaxed in its corporate culture. And when it comes to techies going to work and having to wear suits, it's kind of counterintuitive. And finally, Goldman Sachs is waking up to this fact. But it says that the only guideline is that the techies should exercise judgment when adapting their business suits for casual clothes. I mean, you could probably think there's got to be a market for a pinstriped hoodie somewhere. Hey, a pinstripe hoodie and some really comfortable sneakers that look like back shoes and a tie that's more of a scarf. And then the techies would be more comfortable at work, and then they'd stay in the banks and they wouldn't go and work for the mighty Silicon Valley. But certainly Goldman Sachs finally waking up to this particular trend.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Money Show.
Truth or Bull, brought to you by 10X Investments, undoing the myths around your retirement savings so you get more money when it matters most. Visit 10x.co.za for the facts. Your Truth or Bull challenge this evening: passive investing works only in bull markets. Is it truth or is it bull? Passive investing works only in bull markets. Truth or bull? You've got to give us a call on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. And when you call, you could stand in line to win $1,000 in a 10X unit trust. It's up to you as to what you want to do this evening. Give us truth or give us bull. To tonight's question, passive investing works only in bull markets. What do you think of that?
702, The Money Show. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Your chance to win $1,000 in a 10X unit trust. All you've got to do is answer the truth or bull question. It's brought to you by 10X Investments, undoing the myths around your retirement savings so you get more money when it matters most. Visit 10x.co.za for the facts. Passive investing works only in bull markets. Mark in Mitchell's Plain, is that truth or is it bull?
It is bull.
You're absolutely right, Mark in Mitchell's Plain, and you'll get yourself $1,000 in a 10X unit trust. Well done. I've always been of the opinion, and this is why opinion and fact are so completely different, that a passive investment would work better in a bull market because it's much harder to read a bull market than it is a sideways market. And if markets are moving sideways, is it not easier to outperform them? That's my impression. So the facts are, on average, both index trackers and active investors match the market return before fees. But index investors do pay lower fees. So therefore, you earn a higher average net return than active investors do. It holds true for every market in every country in both bull and bear markets. So the statement passive investing works only in bull markets was in fact bull when you look at the final results. Well done to you, Mark and Mitchell's Plain. $1,000 in a 10X unit trust is winging its way to you. Find out what less than 1% in fees means to your retirement at 10x.co.za. Join us same time tomorrow for another opportunity to win $1,000 in a 10X unit trust.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
When you type in Bell Pottinger into Google, it automatically gives you the option Bell Pottinger scandal. And that's how big this thing is. The artificial intelligence built into Google is associating Bell Pottinger with scandal worldwide. What are the facts, I mean, in terms of what's going on with Bell Pottinger? Certainly, Lord Bell, the co-founder of Bell Pottinger, who left earlier this year, ostensibly because of the company's association with the Guptas and the work they were doing in South Africa. He spoke this week to a magazine called PR Week, Public Relations Week in the United Kingdom. Sam Byrne-James is the news editor at PR Week. Tell us about the conversation you had with Lord Bell, Sam.
Thank you, Bruce. I should first say, actually, yes, it was August last year that August or September last year that Bell stepped away. He didn't at that time mention this work in South Africa as with Oak Bay Investments as being part of his reasons for resigning. But at that point, it wasn't really in the public domain that they were doing that, and there wasn't anything like the controversy and the scandal there is now. My conversation with Bell earlier this week, he's a man who's known for kind of being very charming, very persuasive, absolutely what a highly paid and successful PR professional would be. What he was really trying to get across in this conversation is that none of this was his fault. It was all about the mistakes made by James Henderson and by Victoria Gagan in the who remain in the firm. Clearly, in a case like this, you don't know how much you ought to believe one side or another, because James Henderson, when we've spoken to him, have said that they're completely disputing Lord Bell's state of affairs and or the description of affairs. And Henderson has talked about having been misled by the team on the account, so Gagan and others. It was very much Bell's aim, clearly, to distance himself from what's happened. And he said to me, it is a terrible scandal. But then, as you've described, Bell Pottinger's been through quite a lot of scandals before. He's no stranger
To controversy.
Defending himself in this situation.
No, exactly. I mean, and here you are dealing with two of the masters of the art of public relations, people who are used to moulding information to suit their purposes. And both Lord Bell, who's been in the business for a very, very long time, and of course the chief executive of Bell Pottinger, who we've invited onto the radio, James Henderson, who's declined us. Both of them are experts in the world of ensuring that their messaging is best received, and both of them are being equally vociferous about their point of view. But here's Lord Bell saying of James Henderson, he's the chief executive, for God's sake. It's his job to know what is going on. This is after James Henderson tried to distance himself from the work that was being done in South Africa by Victoria Gagan. I mean, this is everybody trying to throw everybody else under the bus and distance themselves from the bad smell as much as they possibly can.
Yeah, it's kind of really extraordinary that the twists and turns I've seen in this story, and that's just from the point of view of the agency's involvement. That's clearly, us being PR Week, that's what we're really interested in. But in terms of the actual fact of what's happening on the ground, the Gupta family, there's a huge level of complexity. So yeah, it's very difficult, even for a far more skilled journalist than myself to cut through all of this. Back in April, when I spoke to James Henderson around the time that Bell Pottinger said they were stepping back from the account, he kind of flatly denied everything. He said, it's all incorrect. The company, in their statement from Henderson last week, are still denying that it was all incorrect. They're still denying that there's a lot of the accusations are incorrect. They are very firmly saying, no, we've never done any fake social media accounts. Who knows when the law firm that they've hired comes out with its full report or what we see from that. Who knows, what further twists and turns there may be here.
James Henderson furious at Lord Bell because he's saying, well, the law firm hasn't come out with a final ruling yet. We've seen the sort of preliminary ruling. It's enough to be embarrassing. So we've suspended a bunch of people and got rid of Victoria Gagan. That's what we're doing. Lord Bell, would you have the decency to wait until the law firm comes out with its findings? But Lord Bell knows whoever gets out first and whoever makes their point loudest and longest is usually the point who's remembered. I mean, Bell Pottinger has been associated with dark ops in the world of communications around the globe for years.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, just this week, actually, PL Week has run another story about Weber Shandwick, who's so, I think, second biggest firm in the world, stepping back from work with the Egyptian government. You know, we have other names, people working with the Turkish government, you know, Russia, Qatar. So, yeah, it is quite a difficult question for the industry to work out when they should and shouldn't work with a particular individual, because the point Lord Bell would always make is, well, if someone's in a court of law, they deserve to have a lawyer. If someone's in the court of public opinion, then they should probably have, you know, they deserve to have public relations.
Sam Byrne-James, let's leave it there. I thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. The news editor at PR Week, based in the United Kingdom, just off Oxford Street in central London. Sam Byrne-James, giving us any good insight into the sort of pressure that Bell Pottinger is coming under in its own market. It's made it, making it into mainstream news gradually in the UK. Not the sort of furore we're seeing here, of course, because the UK's got its own very parochial problems. Bell Pottinger is likely to survive this. Bell Pottinger is likely to come out of the other side of this, considerably bruised, a lot wiser, and hopefully with a lot more integrity into the future. This is going to kill them? I don't think it's going to kill them. Sam Byrne-James, thanks very much indeed.
The Money Show, FAQs.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a listed financial services provider. How frustrated are you about the total lack of action by South Africa's law enforcement agencies over the growing mountain of evidence in the email leak saga? It's good to see private sector companies appointing inquiries, investigations into themselves. We'll see how effective these are going to be, of course. But here's the question I've been getting this week. What happens in South Africa if one of the international investigations turns up evidence that the law in South Africa has been broken? What happens? Bernard Hotz is the head of business crimes and investigations at Worksmans. He's on the line to us from Joburg. What does happen in this particular case, Bernard?
Good evening, Bruce. I didn't hear the beginning of the conversation.
The question is, and the question I'm getting a lot is, we've got all of these investigations being carried out by private sector companies into themselves. Some are being carried out by international law firms. In the case of SAP, we don't know who's going to carry out their investigation or what the terms of reference are going to be. But the question I'm getting is, what happens if one of these investigations, private investigations, turns up evidence of illegal activity in a country like South Africa? This is an investigation done outside of the country. It's into the company that may have been involved. Does it have legal standing in this country?
Bruce, it's exciting because let's just look at the law. Every country in the world has legislation in place to deal with two aspects, money laundering and corruption. We've talked about the duty to report issues that we have, for instance, in South Africa. So too do these duties exist in the foreign legislation. But most importantly, Bruce, let's assume, for instance, a company has its head office in Germany and an investigation occurs, for instance, in South Africa. The acts have extraterritorial application. In other words, investigators, for instance, from the foreign companies can come into the local country, South Africa, and investigate these offenses. And so too, Bruce, one can take it a step further. If it is found that there's criminal conduct, in certain instances, you may very well find that people are prosecuted, not in South Africa, but in certain instances, they could be prosecuted in the foreign jurisdiction as well.
Okay, so there is a lot of really good stuff happening. While our local investigators seem to have their hands tied, or they seem to be preoccupied, or they're on holiday. It is holiday season, of course, school holidays. We could very well see justice being meted out through the back door, as the case
Absolutely.
Might be.
Absolutely. Bruce, we've got the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. We've got the UK Anti-Bribery Act. And the most important features of these acts, and including the South African Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, is the extraterritorial application of the act. So you cannot hide somewhere obscure in the world and think you can get away with it. The legislation entitles you to go and investigate and prosecute and hold people accountable.
Okay, but you've got to do it. You've still got to have local law enforcement authorities with this body of evidence being presented that would be prepared to do that.
Well, let's take an example. It's generally what should happen in mature in mature economies is that there should be cooperation between law enforcement officers from both jurisdictions. But assuming that this is an investigation which is initiated pursuant to a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act report, the foreign investigators, through utilizing the mutual legal assistance, will come into South Africa, hopefully get cooperation with local law enforcement, conduct their investigations, take the results of those investigations back to, for instance, the United States. Decisions could be made. Are we going to prosecute in the United States? Are we going to prosecute in South Africa? If we're going to prosecute in the United States and we want to prosecute, for instance, a South African resident, how do we do that? That's when the principle of extradition could come into play. All sorts of exciting legal issues which could at long last bring some kind of consequence to this type of conduct.
You watch bad guys all the time. You talk to bad guys all the time. You talk to the law enforcement authorities. Are we beginning to see some real movement here, Bernard, finally being forced upon us rather than being proactively taken?
It's exciting times, Bruce. And yes, we, you know, unfortunately, and I've said this in the past, I wish our law enforcement would have the courage to grasp the matters like the international firms seem to be very scared of contravening their local corruption legislation there and the consequences that they may face from their law enforcement and prosecutorial authorities. It's high time that the locals feel the same fear from our law enforcement and prosecutorial authorities.
Bernard Hartz, the head of business crimes and investigations at Worksmans. After Eyewitness News, Warren Ingram with lessons from Wimbledon to help you make better investment choices. It's all about you. It's all about your investment choices. And it's all about getting away with sitting over the weekend and watching the women's final and the men's final and say, no, 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 we're watching financial programming. Honestly, we are. We're not just slobbing out in front of the TV. That's all coming up after Eyewitness News. Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. I'm going to play to you a little bit of a press conference that was this afternoon. Weird press conference. This is SAP, the global technology giant, which got very cross this week when it was connected to the Gupta emails and allegations of corruption. They've had a press conference today. So I want you to play, I want you to listen to an extract from that as I bring that to you this evening. One of the directors of SAP, Adair Fox-Martin, who got a rough ride from South African journalists and who are reflecting your rage at the Guptas and state capture and everything else. And I don't think they were expecting the sort of hostile reception that they got. Then the lessons that you can learn from Wimbledon with Warren Ingram this evening, then Pavlos Fotidis on your small business and the brand of your small business. And many of you operate in the world of being sole operators, and your brand, your business is you. And why it is that your name is so absolutely pivotal. And you look at the names that are being trashed in the public domain right now, lessons from those names being trashed and what impact it could have on you, your brand, your personal brand, your company's brand, your small enterprise brand, and how it could destroy you if you're not careful.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
If I offered you a bag of rocks and dust, how much would you be prepared to pay for a bag? It's about, I don't know, a kilogram bag of rocks and dust. How much? I mean, it depends, I suppose, on what the rocks and dust are. Diamonds or rocks? That's nice. This is moon dust and moon rock, and it is a sample of the first ever moon rock and dust collected by Neil Armstrong. It's a bag of this stuff, and it's going up for auction on the 20th of July. Why the 20th of July? Oh, it's the anniversary of the moon, I suppose. Sotheby's, it's hosting the auction, estimates the sample bag that was used by Neil Armstrong to collect soil samples on the Apollo 11 mission still contains the moon dust and small rocks. It'll sell for anything between $2 and $4 million. The samples were the very, very first ever collected on the moon. So that gives them a collectability. I mean, what stops you from stopping off on your way between Joburg and Cape Town on your holidays and just going into the Karoo and sweeping up some dust? I mean, honestly. But anyway, this is apparently very valuable. It's an exceptionally rare piece of history, and virtually everything from that mission is held by the Smithsonian Institute. But a recent court ruling allowed this bag to be the only privately held artifact from that first moon landing. a bag of dust and rocks for between $2 and $4 million. I can't wait to see what it sells for.
702 The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Well, just days after threats to sue amidst angry denials of their involvement with the Gupta family and a 100 million rand bribe, SAP has suspended four senior staff members in South Africa. It's investigating itself. SAP saying it's got the necessary PCs, the data to investigate, and it'll publish the outcome of the investigation. SAP's Adair Fox Martin promised an investigation with full integrity and full transparency. Now, you do have to wonder, don't you, what was in the mind of those SAP executives when they initially, without any sort of real investigation of their own, issued those angry denials. The whole thing started at 4 o'clock this afternoon. The SAP executive board member for global customer operations, Adair Fox Martin, briefed a handful of very grumpy South African journalists in a very tightly controlled conference call. This is part of the statement she made this afternoon.
Of course, we've seen the claims in the media, and we are taking these claims very, very seriously. We're initiating a thorough and a vigorous investigation. This investigation will be conducted with full integrity and full transparency. We're conducting the investigation both internally with our own forensic compliance team and externally using an independent third party. While this investigation is ongoing, we have put four members of the management team in South Africa on administrative leave. Many of you may or may not be aware of the technology industry. We certainly have a long value chain in this sector, which involves many partners and many sellers. However, we have a zero tolerance for lack of compliance when it comes to dealing with our customers and with our partners. It is fully our intention that once this investigation is concluded, we will share the results publicly. Now, today, our forensic team are already on the ground. We have begun the internal review. The data that we are reviewing is the data that is available in the SAP system. And we also have access to the PCs, etc., of the employees who are currently on administrative leave. Please remember that we have access to the data that is in the SAP system, and we are working to uncover what we can from that data in as efficient and as effective a method as possible. We, as an executive board in SAP, are very committed to getting to the bottom of this issue. We feel we owe this to our employees, to our customers, to our partners, and to the broader community in South Africa and Africa.
Okay, that's Adair Fox Martin. She is a member of the SAP Executive Board for Global Customer Operations. Some interesting takeouts from the questions that journalists asked afterwards. And was SAP going to reveal the third party that would help with the external investigation? No, it wouldn't be. Would they name the SAP employees that be put on leave? No, they wouldn't be. They reject all allegations against them. They would. But they said they will review the entire business of SAP in South Africa. Now, you look and you do a little bit of a Google search. SAP has been linked to bribery in the past. I think there can be very few global companies that can be completely squeaky clean in this regard. Companies employ people. People can go bad. And some people are bad when they go in. And so it's very hard for a company to automatically deny any complicity because it should take responsibility for the people it appoints. But SAP has been linked to bribery in the past. And I found online today a reference that the US Securities and Exchange Commission made, fining the firm and forcing it to give up nearly $4 million in sales profits and settle charges that it violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act when doing business in Panama. Deficient SAP controls allowed an executive to pay big bribes, 2.5 million rand bribes, to a Panamanian government official for contracts. And it's really interesting that these are global companies operating in challenging markets where sometimes the people will be tempted to fall for paying those bribes. And it's foolish to automatically deny. They've done the right thing now by instigating this investigation, but they are going to be under intense scrutiny as to how they do it, when they do it, and how they're going to deliver the outcome of that particular investigation. It's absolutely crucial that they're seen and believed to be completely transparent.